This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Ira Flatow is away. Well, it's Labor Day weekend, and school is back in session for many students and teachers across the country. No matter how hard you try to deny it, summertime is drawing to a close. So how did you spend your summer vacation this year? Maybe lounging by the pool, hiking in the woods, catching up on Netflix? For some science teachers, the lazy days of summer were the perfect time for, well, for more science. They traded in the beach for the bench. They strapped on their goggles, their lab goggles, to brush up on their science skills. My next guests are 7th and 8th grade teachers here to tell us about how they spent their summer vacations. Nell Herman is a science teacher at Blue Hill Consolidated School in Blue Hill, Maine. Nell, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
And Genevia Merrick is a science teacher at the Harbor Science and Arts Charter School in New York City, and she joins us right here in our studios. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to start with you, Nell. You spent the summer on a research boat called the EV Nautilus. Tell us about what you worked on.
Yeah, it was really great. I was really fortunate to have the opportunity to work as an educator on a program run by a nonprofit called Ocean Exploration Trust, or OET. And the president of OET is Dr. Robert Ballard, who's well known for many things, including his discovery of the Titanic shipwreck. So OET operates this vessel called EV Nautilus, which uses big underwater robots or remotely operated vehicles to explore the deep sea. And the ship also uses telepresence to broadcast the science live in real time through their website, nautiluslive.org. So I got to be on board this summer as an educator who was assisting my friend and colleague Sam Garson with the Honors Research Program for high school students. So each year, 8 kids from all over the U.S. are selected to participate, and they are rising seniors who spend a month with me and Sam at the University of Rhode Island Graduate School of Oceanography. And there they work on some STEM-focused projects and get to interact with scientists from all kinds of academic and government institutions, including NOAA and Woods Hole, and they get to interact with Dr. Ballard himself. And then sort of the culminating event is a 10-week trip on EV Nautilus, where they get to be involved directly with the research happening on the ship.
And how is teaching kids on a boat different than it is in the classroom?
Oh, it's different in so many ways. The kids actually stood watch every day, twice every 24 hours for 4 hours. And so that obviously affected their sleep cycle. You know, teenagers need a lot of sleep, so that was an adjustment for them. And it was pretty interesting because at first they were a little bit timid and a little bit shy to dive in and interact with the scientists and engineers and other people on the ship. But after a few days, the kids I worked with were really right in the thick of it, and it was really great to be part of it. I was very proud of them.
And can you tell us a little bit more about what they were working on?
Yeah, well, so while we were on shore at URI, they did many kind of STEM-focused projects, but probably the biggest one was a student drifter. And this was part of a program that actually started about 10 years ago by folks at the NOAA Lab in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. And if any educators are interested in learning more about it, there's a great website, studentdrifters.org. But the kids engineered these low-cost hand-built drifters that include a small GPS unit, and then we deployed them off the ship. And the drifters are used to track ocean currents via satellite telemetry. So we launched them off EV Nautilus off the coast of Southern California in August, and we're still collecting data from them. So that's pretty exciting.
Very cool. So, okay, Genevia, how about you? You spent your summer in an engineering lab at New York University. Why did you choose to spend your summer doing research?
I did, and it was great. I chose to spend my summer doing research because I really wanted to gain experience, again, in research so that I can bring it back to my classroom. In science classes, most labs are prescribed. So students are told basically what they're researching. They're following steps in order to investigate something. So I wanted to engage my students in research, give them opportunity to know how to come up with steps to solve a problem that they may have. So I wanted to experience it myself so that students would be able to know what I went through, and I would be able to guide them to doing research, you know, in the future.
So you worked on an engineering project for about 6 weeks. What were you working on?
Okay, for 6 weeks, well, I had 2 weeks of classes in mechatronics, which is a combination of electrical engineering and mechanical engineering, where I learned about circuits, and I learned how to program, and I learned how to build a robot using Arduino and Paralex. And so after that, we were placed into different labs of our choice. And so the lab that I chose was the Geotechnical Engineering Lab. And it was interesting because I was an engineer before teaching, and the Geotechnical Engineering Lab is very, very different. I teach earth science, so it was great because I got a chance to test different soils and actually learn what civil engineers do.
That's very cool. So different types of engineering you were able to bring back, and you'll be able to bring those into the classroom. I understand you ran into a few problems, though, with your project. What happened?
I did. Well, first, there was the problem of design. So we had to design a structure which we would be able to show capillary rise. So our project was to model for students capillary rise in different types of soil. And then we had to build a structure, which was a little challenging. But then afterwards, we were challenged to design a system and program it so that it would measure the level of water moisture in soil. And so I used an Arduino, which is a microcontroller, created a circuit, and I thought it was great. I was like, oh, I wrote the program, created the circuit, and then, of course, it caught fire.
Of course. So it caught fire. So you have to deal with a little bit of failure. And
yes.
But this is an important thing, right? You got to take this back to the classroom.
Yes.
And it seems as though students today are so hyper-focused on getting things right that the idea of teaching failure kind of falls by the wayside. You're able to bring back your experience and say, I experienced a little bit of failure myself, and here's what I learned from it.
Yes. So, and that's true, because students are so focused on getting things right. But science is not about getting things right. Science is learning through experiments. And most scientists, even in throughout history, did not get things right the first time. So I can tell my students, look, as much as I know and what theory says, and I followed steps of what I thought I should be able to do, I still failed. And it took failure for me to learn how to get it right. And it's still a lot of work because there's still things that I don't know, you know, that students will definitely learn and they can experiment themselves, because I can just tell them, okay, I got to this point. Now let's see what else we can do.
Now, Nell Herman, in the summer of 2009, you worked on a study researching caribou, and you're bringing part of that project into your classroom this year. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So in 2009, I was actually teaching in Pennsylvania, and it's really kind of a funny story. At a back-to-school night, after my presentation, a couple of parents approached me and told me a little bit about their research on caribou and climate change in southwestern Greenland. And they told me that they had funding to take a teacher along to assist with their research and asked if I'd be interested. And I about did a backflip on the spot and said, yeah, you know, when can we go? So I was able to work with Dr. Eric Post from Penn State University and his research team to help as a field assistant that year. And it was fun because I was able to email my classroom. It was actually in May, so it was still during school, and send photographs and updates about what I was doing. And when I came back, I brought all kinds of crazy things that I'd found in the tundra, like caribou antlers and, you know, Arctic fox scat and snowshoe hare fur and all these kinds of things, and got the students pretty excited about, you know, learning about the Arctic and climate change and tundra ecosystems. But I sort of thought things might end there. But fortunately, I've stayed connected to Eric and his wife and their research team through the Polar Center at Penn State University. And Eric recently submitted a grant to NSF that is going to be funded. And so my students and I will be part of it, and I'm really excited about it. We're going to be setting up these small kind of fiberglass cones on the playground at my school, which will warm the temperature of the plants by just a degree or two. And then we'll take different measurements on the plants and compare those to control plots on the same playground. And this is kind of modeling the things that are happening with climate change. Even just slight temperature rises will affect plant development. And really, it's mimicking Eric's research that he's been doing in Greenland for 20 years. So he's shown that just a degree or two change in temperature is speeding up plant development enough that it's impacting caribou, because when they arrive to they're breeding grounds. There's not enough food for them to eat because the plants have already completed their life cycle. So my students will be kind of mimicking his experimental design, but the neat thing is they'll be entering the data into a big database that they'll share with students from different schools all over the world who will be doing the same kind of experiment. So it's going to be my students from Maine, some kids from Alaska, from Colorado, from Denmark, and from Greenland, and they're all going to be sharing their data and their information and Skyping with one another. And our hope is that down the road we can have some kind of science symposium for the kids and possibly even take kids to Greenland to see Eric's research site. So
wow.
I'm pretty psyched about it.
Well, it sounds like both of you have had some amazing experiences in the field yourself. And Genevieve, just bringing that back to the students, it seems so important for them to have the hands-on experience and to learn through you because you've had so much yourself this summer, right?
Yes, and I think that that's a plus because I would be able to relate to some of the students' struggles, and they understand that I'm not just coming from a college, but I've actually experienced it. I think research is something that we need to encourage students to do more of. It opens up the world of engineering because right now, everything technology, and students need to be exposed to technology in every area. And I think research really will expose them to technology as well as other areas of science, particularly my students. I want them to know what engineers are, what they do. There are different types of engineers. Give them options for the future. So I think that my experience this summer will allow them to do that. I've made connections where engineers are going to come into my classroom, so it's great.
Well, I want to thank Genevieve Merrick, a science teacher at the Harbor Science and Arts Charter School in New York City. Thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I'm glad you had a good summer.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Nell Herman, a science teacher at Blue Hill Consolidated School in Blue Hill, Maine. Thank you so much, Nell.
Thank you very much. It's been fun. Have a good school year, Genevieve.
Thank you. You did the same.
Coming up after the break, why the history of autism, as told in some school textbooks, might be wrong. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. We tend to think of autism as a modern disease, or as my next guest, Steve Silberman, writes, the unique disorder of our uniquely disordered times. But that idea, he says, doesn't quite square with history. His new book, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity, explores that history. He takes us back to Vienna before the Second World War, where he introduces us to a young doctor named Hans Asperger. That's a familiar name to many of you. Back in the 1930s, Asperger was already studying what he believed to be a widespread condition among the children of his day, a mostly heritable condition composed of a whole spectrum of symptoms. Yet despite these insights, Silberman writes that Asperger was largely left out of the textbooks. We'll let him continue the story in a moment. Steve Silberman is a science writer and the author of Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. He joins us today from KQED. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much, John. It's great to be here.
And we do have an excerpt of the book at sciencefriday.com/neurotribes. And if you want to join us, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. So continue the story for us of Hans Asperger in wartime Vienna.
Well, he was an extremely visionary and humane clinician. His clinic was not just the sort of place where parents would bring their children for evaluation and a diagnosis, but it was also like a residential school. So Asperger and his colleagues actually lived with the children intimately, and they had classes there. Each day they would study a new subject like geometry or history. They had PE classes with music in the morning. And so it was really a total environment that was designed to both allow the clinicians to observe the children very closely, but also allow them to become more comfortable with themselves and with each other, because many of them had been considered very difficult children. They had been expelled from a series of schools. Some of the children had been sent there by the courts. So in a way, Asperger's clinic was sort of a clinic of last resort for many of the children. But Asperger and his colleagues made it a very, very wonderful place. Asperger himself would occasionally just sit with the children and read poetry to them, actually. Mm. So it was a very, very humane environment and way ahead of its time in that way. And the ideas about autism that Asperger and his colleagues developed there were decades ahead of their time. For example, Asperger and his colleagues conceived of autism as a lifelong condition lasting from birth to death, requiring special forms of support from the family and teachers and the community. He saw the very, very broad range of what we now call the autism spectrum. So some children were unable to speak and might require individual support for the rest of their lives, while others, one of his very profoundly disabled former young patients ended up sort of begging his teachers to give him advanced classes in math and science, and he ended up going to graduate school, finding a flaw in one of Isaac Newton's proofs and becoming an assistant professor of astronomy, even though he was still very autistic, blatantly autistic, as Asperger put it, and couldn't even recognize the faces of familiar people passing in the street. So Asperger knew really a lot about autism, and he had a great team of colleagues there. But then, as anyone who's familiar with European history of the late 1930s knows, something very, very bad happened, which was that the Nazis marched into Austria and annexed the country for the German fatherland. And around the same time, the Nazis started passing eugenic laws, which compelled any form of clinicians and nurses to report disabled children to Berlin. And in fact, the Nazis eventually undertook a secret extermination program of disabled children and adults as part of their effort to purge the gene pool of hereditary forms of illness, as they put it. And that actually became the dry run for the Holocaust. That was where the Nazis developed methods of mass murder that they would eventually use on the Jews. So at that point, Asperger had to protect the children in his clinic from even his own supervisors at the hospital. And in fact, the Gestapo came to the clinic to arrest him several times. But luckily, a supervisor of his, who was a very prominent Nazi, liked him and seemed to protect him from the Gestapo. So Asperger was doing amazing work under the worst possible conditions, I would say.
And I'm wondering if you can talk more about some of the symptoms that he was describing, because when we hear his name, we think of the condition Asperger's syndrome, but he was really describing a much broader spectrum than that, or maybe even perhaps a broader spectrum than the autism spectrum that we talk about today.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what he described was mapped pretty much close to what we now call the autism spectrum. But he described children who would engage in kind of repetitive behavior, were very much disliked and bullied by their peers, could not seem to pick up on the fact that they would sort of talk endlessly about the subjects of their fascination and not pick up on the signals that they were boring the people they were talking to. One of the reasons why Asperger, I think, was fascinated by these children was because he himself had sort of a reputation when he was young of being a kind of tedious, pedantic kid. And he was obsessed with this poet who was sort of a goth poet in a way named Grill Parser. And so, you know, he would get lost in books for days on end and forget that he had to do his homework. So I think one of the reasons why Asperger related to these children was that he himself was an odd outcast child, and he became fascinated with these children who seemed to move through the world in a kind of private world of their own. And so those were the children he described. But one of the things that I discovered to write the book was the very first talk on autism that was ever given in history by Hans Asperger in 1938 to what was certainly an audience of Nazis, because he was speaking to his supervisors and the country had been completely swept by the mania for Hitler. And what he did was he said that he is describing his most promising cases. And I think the reason why he described his most promising cases in the paper he would eventually write was that he knew that if he described his, you know, less promising cases, that the Nazis would target them for extermination.
We're talking, so, yeah, I just wanted to let our audience know that we're talking with Steve Silberman, who's the author of the new book, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. If you want to join us, 844-724-8255, that's 844-PSY-TALK. And all of the work that Asperger did that you describe in the book in many ways is forgotten by much of history, in part because of a rivalry with another scientist named Leo Kanner. Can you just tell us about that rivalry and why we know about autism more through that lens than through the Asperger lens today?
Well, what's so fascinating that I actually discovered for the book, no one's ever written about this, is that one of the things that happened under the Nazis was that Jewish clinicians had to flee the country or die. And one of the clinicians who was forced to flee the country was George Frankl, who was Asperger's chief diagnostician. And another colleague of Asperger's who also fled the country was a woman named Ani Weiss, who wrote really the first case history of an autistic child from Asperger's clinic. Anyway, they leave the country. Where do they go? They go to Baltimore because they're rescued. Well, Ani wasn't. She actually went to America earlier. But George is rescued from the Holocaust by an American clinician named Leo Kanner. It looks like Kanner, but it's actually Kanner. So what happened was George Frankl started working for Leo Kanner in 1938, and they got along very well. They would lead public clinics together where parents would bring their children for evaluation, in fact. And so another person who arrived in Leo Kanner's world in 1938 was a kid named Donald Triplett. And Donald Triplett is considered Leo Kanner's first autistic patient. In fact, he's considered sort of the first autistic patient because Kanner got his paper out a year before Asperger's. Anyway, so he shows up at Kanner's clinic, and Kanner doesn't know what to do with him. He has seen some of these symptoms before in children that he called pre-psychotic, but he basically isn't able to make a diagnosis. And so he sends Donald Triplett to George Frankl for evaluation. Well, George Frankl was quite familiar with children like this because he had just spent 11 years working in Asperger's clinic, seeing scores of autistic children, perhaps up to a couple of hundred, at all levels of ability. So Frankl knew just what to make of Donald Triplett. And in fact, Frankl evaluated Kanner's first three autistic patients. And so then in 1943, Kanner writes his paper that makes him the world's leading authority on autism. And it begins with the statement, since 1938, a number of children have come to our attention, etc. And historians have sort of puzzled over that for a very long time. What does he mean by 1938? And then, you know, they came to the conclusion that what he means is that Donald Triplett showed up. Well, that's true, but George Frankl also showed up, who knew what to look for. And so the problem is, well, there are a couple of problems. For one thing, Kanner never mentioned Asperger's work ever, ever, ever in his voluminous writings on autism, which, you know, hundreds of papers. In fact, he doesn't mention Asperger's name in public until the 70s when he says, oh, yes, Asperger. And it's kind of in a book review in the back of this obscure journal. He says, oh, yes, Asperger. That what that man discovered was, at best, a 42nd cousin of my syndrome that has already received serious attention. Because by then, Kanner had been the world's leading authority on autism. The problem for autistic people and their families was that Kanner defined autism much more narrowly than Asperger had done. For one thing, he called it early infantile autism. So it was definitely a condition of early infancy. Kanner also eventually, although he didn't do it at first, he eventually blamed parents for triggering autism in their children. The familiar image of the refrigerator mother came from Connor's work, not the work of Bruno Bettelheim, although Bettelheim sort of made a career out of it later. But it was really Connor who thought up that horrible idea. And what's so bad about that idea is that Connor's recommended course of treatment for autism became institutionalization,
which is of course one of the problems that's so many decades of people who are dealing with autism have faced. We want to get to some calls in a moment. 844-724-8255. Let's go to Chrissy, who's calling from South Carolina. Hi, Chrissy.
Hi. Thank you for having me on.
Of course. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to say I just downloaded the book because I'm very fascinated by it. It personally affects my family. I have a 10-year-old son with autism. And I think one of the interesting things about kids with autism is there's all these preconceived notions about what they're like and what they do. And my son is just one of the most wonderful kids you'd ever want to meet. And he has a lot of the strange little quirky things, you know, that you see with kids, but so many of the things are not what you expect. So I cannot wait to read this book. I think it's going to be very interesting. So thank you for writing.
That is so great to hear. It is so wonderful to hear about a mom who really appreciates her child and doesn't see him through the lens of all these false beliefs that accumulated in psychiatry over the decades.
Chrissy, thank you very much for your phone call. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking to Steve Silberman, whose book is Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. Asperger talks about autistic intelligence, which you write was a quote, bold suggestion that autistic people have played an unappreciated role in the evolution of culture. And I think that's what Chrissy, I'm sure a lot of callers right now and listeners might want to talk about, is the gifts of the autistic person.
That's the thing. Asperger appreciated the gifts and aptitudes of his kids. And in fact, he had to overcome a kind of personal skepticism at first about these gifts because, for one thing, he noticed that a lot of his young patients seemed to be fascinated with science fiction and rocket ships. And at first he wrote, "One can see how remote from reality, you know, the interests of autistic children are." Anyway, he would take back that statement later, once the whole world had become obsessed with rocket ships, in a sense, which was not that long after that. So Asperger always appreciated that autism was a condition that conveyed both profound disabilities and very special gifts. Connor, on the other hand, interpreted even the gifts of his patients through sort of the lens of psychopathology. So he thought that, for instance, one of the kids in his clinic who could instantly identify 18 symphonies before he turned 2, Connor thought that boy was just trying to impress his parents and in a kind of desperate plea for their affection. So Connor had a much dimmer view of the special gifts of autistic kids than Asperger did.
The way you end your book is really as part of a plea to redesign the world to perhaps make it easier, more acceptable for autistic people. We have just about a minute and a half, please, Steve, but I'm wondering if you can go into that and talk about what the world might do to better adapt for autistic individuals.
Well, we know how to adapt to, for instance, people who use wheelchairs. We build accessible buildings and make curb cuts so that they can freely travel around. So we can do a cognitively accessible world by, say, presenting lessons and curricula in different formats for visual or audio learners. We can provide quiet spaces in schools so that kids are, you know, who are like facing a meltdown because they're sensorily overloaded because they have autism, can go chill out. Mm-hmm. We can do autism-friendly performances on Broadway, which have already been a fantastic success, with less pyrotechnics and social stories beforehand so the kids don't get surprised. We know how to deal with disability, and we just have to rise to the challenge instead of thinking that we can make autism go away if we throw enough money at it.
Your book is a fascinating history, and I want to thank you for joining us. Steve Silberman is a science writer, the author of Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism, and the Future of Neurodiversity. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
If you'd like to read an excerpt of the book, it's at sciencefriday.com/neurotribes. Coming up after the break, have you given online dating a try? We're talking about how technology is shaping modern romance. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. It's not like dating was ever easy, but finding love in the age of the internet has some rather unique challenges. In his stand-up special, Aziz Ansari, live at Madison Square Garden, the comedian recounts the anxiety that sets in after you ask someone out via text.
Any guy or girl in that situation, that's what they're feeling. And you're just waiting for something to put your heart at ease. But instead, you're getting nothing. And then you go on the internet, you're reading stuff like, eating ice cream and watching Dexter, hash mark, I really need a man. What, I just asked you out. You know I follow you. You know I'm reading this. What kind of evil is inside of you?
Unanswered texts and social media-driven detective work are sometimes part of the romantic landscape today. Ansari set out to catalog these and other aspects of dating in a scientific way in his book, Modern Romance, which came out earlier this summer. He teamed up with sociologist Eric Kleinenberg to understand how technology and our expectations affect the way we date. Eric Kleinenberg joins me now. He's co-author of Modern Romance and a professor of sociology at New York University. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Also here to talk about modern dating is Lucy Hunt. She's a PhD candidate in human development and family sciences at the University of Texas at Austin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Jess Carbino, a sociologist at Tinder, who is about to complete her PhD at UCLA. Welcome, Jess.
Thank you, John. Glad to be here.
If you want to join us about the science of modern dating, 844-724-8255. That phone number is 844-SCI-TALK. So, Eric, when you and Aziz were researching this book, Perfect Strangers handed over their phones and let you read their texts. As a sociologist, what was it like to have that kind of access to people?
Oh, it was nirvana. I mean, that is the dream of a social scientist, to get access to data like that, and it's so hard to do. Normally we interview people, we do surveys, we get their memories of what happened, their stories about what happened. With some dating sites like Tinder or OkCupid these days, if you're lucky, you can get access to data about the way people really behave. But to get inside of people's phones and to read the transcripts of the exchanges they have while texting or on a dating site, it's just amazing.
Anything really surprise you in reading those?
Well, you know, I guess the main thing is we're really in it together, in the sense that we have this new technology that has changed the way we connect with each other. And we've collectively failed to figure out what the norms are. So people are constantly guessing about, should I text? Should I call? Should I friend on Facebook? If I do text, what should I say? If I get a message, how long should I wait before I write back? And there's really no getting out of that kind of confusion or gaminess. And I guess, the surprise was, there's a lot of common problems that we need to look at together, and that's what the book is about.
Now, while online dating has lost most of its stigma here in the United States, some are still wary of dating sites and apps. Here's what Aziz Ansari told Science Friday about Tinder, which he also talks about in the book.
There's all these articles now about like how Tinder is like the end of society or whatever, and it's like, no, it's just a different way of meeting people. Like, when you see someone's face at a bar or a party in real life, what do? You look at the face and you're like, oh, that face feels good to me when I look at it. I'm going to go and talk to them. And then you go talk to them and they say some stuff back, and then they go, okay. And to me, that's the same thing as Tinder. You're just looking at a face on the screen and then you're swiping right if you're attracted to it, or left if you're not. It's not this horrible invention. I think it's fine.
Okay, so Jess, you're a sociologist at Tinder. First of all, for people who don't know, what is Tinder?
Sure. Tinder is a mobile dating application that allows individuals to connect with other people in their area and have a connection. And what's wonderful about Tinder, and I think what really has been the biggest innovation in the mobile dating space, is that Tinder requires users to mutually match or to double opt in prior to communicating. So in the past, on dating apps or on dating sites, women and men acted blindly when messaging each other and initiating contact. But with Tinder, individuals know that the other person is interested in interacting with them and talking with them because they both agree to match with one another. So there's a degree of comfort and security for both parties when interacting.
So what does a sociologist at Tinder do?
So my position as a sociologist is to really understand our user behavior and help to make our user experience better through analyzing their behavior.
Okay. So I want to turn to Lucy here. You've done work on mate value with Paul Eastwick. It's featured in this book we've been talking about. Can you explain what mate value is and how it comes into play in a situation like online dating?
Sure. The most general way of thinking about mate value is someone's desirability as a potential romantic partner. So the easiest way to think of it is, okay, she's a 7 out of 10, she's a 4 out of 10, that sort of thing. And traditionally, we think about these in sort of more evolutionary terms, so the genetic or material contributions that you can bring to a relationship. But nowadays, we assess it usually using traits, so how attractive, intelligent, humorous another person is, and kind of rate them and figure out, you know, their mate value that way.
Okay, so, and does mate value change over time? You get to know someone, does their mate value go up, down?
Yes, actually, it really does matter how well you know the person. What's interesting is that when you first meet someone, so in an initial impression context, like a speed date or a first date, you see more agreement in, okay, you know, the extent to which somebody is a 7 out of 10 or a 3 out of 10. But then as you get to know them over time, those mate value evaluations become increasingly unique, meaning deviating from that, you know, initial consensus. So you're more likely to see someone in a different way than you would when you initially met them, just by virtue of getting to know them better over time.
Okay, so Jess, but let's go back to that initial thing. Your first impression online is usually a photo of someone. Do certain profile pictures actually get more attention than others? I imagine some get a lot of attention, but what can you tell us about this?
Oh, yes.
Absolutely.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead, Jess.
Oh, me. Okay. Hi. So what is really interesting to think about with a picture is that individuals have this ability to understand cues that are provided in the photographs. So very thin slices of information are being provided to individuals via this photograph, and they are able to take those slices of information subconsciously and internalize that to understand a lot of characteristics about the person, ranging from their class background to how attractive they are. And the types of photos that really prove most successful for our users are photographs that provide them with a lot of information regarding their interests, personality, and background. And that's not only to establish initial compatibility in terms of matching, but also in subsequent conversations after matching, you are able to communicate with them more easily because you have fodder for conversation and you have a basis by which to communicate.
Lucy, did you want to pick up on that?
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say that there has been work done, and I think this is mentioned a lot in the book, on kind of what pictures do better than others, and, you know, what kind of male pictures look better versus female pictures. I was just going to add.
And we're talking about the book Modern Romance and some of the technology and science behind modern romance today on the program. Eric, another book, something else that comes up in the book is about choice. Is there such a thing as too much choice in the dating world?
Well, yeah, I was just about to say that. I mean, the paradox is that, you know, what Lucy and Jess are telling us is that we look for deeper information about people, and we need that deeper information to make a decision about whether we're really interested in them, whether they're attractive to us in a way that's meaningful and potentially long-lasting. And yet the context of online dating, especially with these swipe apps like Tinder, is that we see just an enormous number of faces, and the faces look to us like options. And a lot of contemporary daters have this experience of feeling overwhelmed by all the choices out there. And the issue is, we know from lots of research, especially the kind of celebrated research of Barry Schwartz, who wrote The Paradox of Choice, and Sheena Iyengar at Columbia, that if we have a world of choices, we wind up being really confused. On the first, we have a very hard time making a decision about the best option. And then when we do make a decision about the best option, we tend to have more regret about it. We don't enjoy the choice we made because we think about all the other things that are out there that we missed. You apply that to jam, and it's a pretty simple story. Apply that to, that's the classic study. But in the world of dating, when we're talking about people, it creates a minefield. And we talk to so many people people who are struggling because they're just swiping through options out there way too quickly. They're getting exhausted and burned out on dating. I think actually that's one of the reasons that Tinder has become popular. It feels a little bit more like a game than it does to be sitting at home at your computer just going through face after face and profile after profile.
Eric's co-author, Aziz Ansari, actually had an idea for an experiment that would look at what happens when people focus on fewer potential partners.
You take one person that goes out with people just like once and only goes out with them again if they really feel like it was like a 10, like a 9 or a 10 experience. And then you have another group where no matter what, they have to go out people like 5 times and really spend a lot of time with them. I feel like the group that spends more time with people would end up being the happier people.
Eric, does that sound about right?
I think that's right, and I think that's what Lucy and her colleague Paul Eastwick at Texas have shown in part with their terrific research. And yet it really takes some doing to try to persuade daters that they wouldn't be better off by spending more time with fewer people. You know, we met people who would go on Tinder while they were on their way to a date with someone they'd met on Tinder, and then if after 10 minutes they didn't feel like an immediate love connection with that person, they'd excuse themselves, run to the bathroom, and get back on Tinder and look to see who else was out there. So that's nothing against Tinder. I actually, you know, like Aziz, think that it's a terrific app that does a lot of great things, but people aren't going to find the answer for their romantic lives by manically swiping through the options in their search for the best. There is no one best when it comes to the relationship. And it's going to be very hard to find your soulmate that way.
In response to some of these ideas, we asked our audience a related question on Twitter and Facebook. We wanted to know how many dates do you need to go on before you know it's going to work out? And we heard from over 400 people. The winning number was 3 dates with over 27% of the responses. 2 dates and 6 or more dates was tied with around 22%. 13% knew after just 1 date if they like someone. Is just 1 date enough to actually get enough data, Lucy?
I couldn't tell you with 1 date, but in a classmate study we did, we found that in a part of a large lecture class, students would break up for 1 hour a week in smaller groups of about 16 or 17 students, and we got their romantic evaluations at week 2 and then again at week 14, and you did see consensus go down a lot. Which means that whatever you got at that, you know, week 2, so that second class of being together, whatever your mate value evaluation was, that agreement went down. So if you saw someone initially as a 5, it either, you know, went to something like a 7 or, you know, it even went down to a 2. And it's kind of as a function of we meet people in different contexts and, you know, and you behave differently in different contexts. So the more information you have about the person, it's easier to acquire that after more dates. So, you know, the first date is just already a nervous experience. And, you know, I would say maybe give people a chance, you know, beyond just the first date, unless I suppose it's an absolute disaster.
But I've got to jump in and say one thing about that. We spent a lot of time talking to people about their first dates. And it turns out that people, especially those who are doing online dating, do the most boring things on their first dates. And that's a real problem we identified. You're much less likely to fall for someone and find that deeper thing that makes you interested in them if you're exchanging resumes at Starbucks. You know, we talked to this one guy who decided, I didn't want to invest too much in a first date because I don't want to spend too much money. I don't want to spend too much time. So he would only take first dates to a bowling alley, he told us. And Aziz and I thought, like, oh, a bowling alley, that sounds kind of fun. You know, like, you'd go bowling, you'd play a game, that could be cool. And he's like, no, we weren't going to go bowling. We'd go to the lounge and have a beer. It's like, that's just so lame. So if you can find something that's more interesting and stimulating, that'll give you and the person you're meeting a chance to express yourselves a little bit more and not just do the predictable resume exchange, I think that's also going to increase the odds of you figuring out whether that's the kind of person you'd want to spend time with.
Well, that sounds like a good tip. Don't be boring. I'm John Dankosky. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Online dating hasn't caught on everywhere, though. Here's more from Aziz Ansari on what he found when he visited Japan.
It just didn't fit with their culture for some reason. Like, for example, you know, profile pictures, you know, just taking pictures of yourself. Like, in Japanese culture, that's very narcissistic, and it doesn't come off well. And so that kind of creates a hurdle because that's a big part of online dating. So I was like, well, what do people post a profile picture of? And they're like, they'll post a picture of, you know, maybe their rice cooker And I was like, what, the rice cooker? And they're like, yeah, guys like post a photo of their rice cooker. So you can see how that would create problems in an online dating climate.
Eric, were you surprised that the culture of online dating was so different in, say, Japan versus the U.S.?
We really were. I mean, we went to Japan thinking these guys are going to have this problem solved. I mean, after all, this is the culture that invented the emoji. You know, what help do they need from the rest of the world? But it turns out that online dating just wasn't really working there. At the same time, you know, I went to Qatar and Doha specifically, and new technologies were creating all kinds of ways for people to meet each other and share information and connect. It turned out Snapchat was huge among younger people who are really forbidden from dating in many contexts. So it's not just about the technology, it's also about the kind of cultural surround. And we learned that, you know, technology can't solve problems on their own. You know, the only way to really, you know, make the connection is to use the technology as, like, Helen Fisher, the anthropologist, says this. We shouldn't think of them online dating as online dating sites. We should think of them as introducing services. The technology is just a vehicle to get you face-to-face.
Hey, Jess, I want to give you the last word here. I mean, how much of it do you think is technology? How much is technology really changing dating these days?
I really believe that technology is not changing dating, but rather that individuals are looking for new institutions to find partners. Historically, individuals have found partners through religious institutions such as churches, synagogues, through educational institutions. But as we know, there are larger demographic and social changes happening in the United States with people delaying marriage and childbearing, moving farther away from family and friends who traditionally introduced individuals to one another. And so online dating or mobile dating apps are really being the new institutions that are replacing pre-existing institutions with mechanisms by which to meet new partners.
Jess Carbina is a sociologist at Tinder who's about to complete her PhD at UCLA. Jess, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, John.
Lucy Hunt is a PhD candidate in human development and family sciences at the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you, Lucy.
Thank you very much.
And Eric Kleinenberg is co-author, along with Aziz Ansari, of the book Modern Romance. He's also a sociologist at New York University. Thank you, Eric.
Thanks. It was great fun.
You can hear more from Aziz Ansari and read an excerpt from the book on our website, sciencefriday.com/modernromance. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. If you like us, well, then like us on Facebook. You can continue a week-long discussion on Twitter at SciFry. You can also write us the old-fashioned way, the way we used to write letters to people we loved. Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412. New York, New York, 10036. IRA is back next week. In New York, I'm John Dankosky.